Welcome to New Line Home Video's Platinum Edition of Wag the Dog. On this track you will hear director Barry Levinson and actor Dustin Hoffman. Director Barry Levinson.
David and I kind of talked about all the things that we found, crazy about, the politics today, Hollywood today, and the media today, and the public today. And from that, we had all of these, these discussions, and then you talk about some specific, people, and then you kind of feed that into the mix and end up with Wag the Dog. Well, before we shot, we needed to do a lot of, work because we're going to have all the playback during the film. So we had to design the commercials beforehand. How were they going to be shot? What kind of style do we want to work in? Same thing applied to, the commercial that the other side is working on about Thank Heavens for Little Girls. How that thing would look. And so that we had a number of things, including how the correspondents would be talking on all of the, the video pieces that ran through the movie. So there was a nice chunk of pre-planning to get all those things on their feet in advance.
Can I get you a step this way, Mr. Breen? Lift your arms, please.
That's him. That's Mr.
The irony is that the Firefly girl, I said to... the photographer, I want the back of the president, leaning over a little bit, and I want the girl with the beret looking up at the president, sort of in awe, and was sort of positioned, and we shot it that way, which ended up turning out to be the photograph they're always showing of Monica Lewinsky in a beret looking up at the president. It was look like it was sort of kind of ironic that it happened that way. I always thought that the steps to me was sort of humorous, that it's like, how far underground are they possibly going to have this meeting? Because they keep going down the steps and down the steps and down the steps. This is happening very far underground. And, this bunker, set up, which is sort of kind of a quietly amusing setup for the information we're about to get. Well, we tried to shoot the movie in continuity as much as possible. A few times you can't do it, but we did start off with, going down the steps, going down the hall, on the way to the bunker, shooting in the bunker, doing all of that, going on the airplane to fly, to arrive in Los Angeles at Stanley Moss's house. Those things, the starting off in the tanning, bed, the press conference, and all of the scenes that played out were all done in pure continuity because... I thought it was important when you're doing a movie of this sort that you can kind of really follow that way of doing it rather than jumping around. The other hand is we were only shooting in a 29-day schedule, and it would be beneficial that if you're shooting that fast that you get as much momentum and continuity as possible to help you with your character.
All right, you kids here in this room, what you hear here, what you say here, what you do here, if it gets out, you leaked it. Tell them what they need to know.
Oh, and it broke. The president said one thing. Get me Conrad Breen.
Anyway, what's the thing? You had an illegal immigrant 90-some years back.
Breen, the concept of a spinmeister who, after a speech, is saying, this, actually we were doing, that kind of, thing, I don't think is... is where we're working. It works on a much, much more, convoluted, far more thoughtful and sinister level than the concept of the spinmeister, And so you talk to different people and try to get some information about what you would do, how would you do it, and go from there. Well, I think to Breen and to Stanley Moss, there is no sense of morality other than to accomplish the agenda. The agenda is what needs to be accomplished, and you do whatever is necessary. And they don't understand. There is no right and wrong to it. It's just these are the things you may have to do in order to accomplish something. He is the fireman, and puts out the fire and moves on to the next thing. He is a hired gun who comes in does what's needed, and moves on. That's why during the movie they said, exactly what do you do for the president? You know what I mean? They're always, Stanley's always, exactly what do you do for the president? He always keeps asking, and then Breen never says anything at all. That's Breen literally lives and breathes for those times, does that work, and then recedes back into the woodwork.
Right, and it's got nothing to do with the B-3 bomber.
There is no B-3 bomber.
I just said that. There is no B-3 bomber, and I don't know...
Bob and Jane, with, you know, their Tribeca Productions, optioned the book. And talked to Dustin about, you know, being involved in the project. And I read the screenplay, which I didn't care for. I thought it was, you know, good, but it wasn't something that interests me enough, you know. And so they said, well, we'll go back and, you know, take a look at the book. And I went back and I looked at the book and I said, well, the same thing applies. I mean, I think this is interesting, but it doesn't get me excited enough to kind of want to say, oh yeah, let's go with that. And so we had a meeting in San Francisco, and with De Niro and Dustin and Jane and Mike DeLuca, and we were talking about in general, and I was saying that I was interested in, you know, in the media manipulation and the whole number of things which became, you know, WAG. And I was talking about the Gulf War specifically, about how you can, you know, fake visuals, that you could take anything that took place in the Gulf War and you could fake it very easily. And I said, that sort of fascinates me, the level of deception that can take place and how easy it is to manipulate, you know, media images and feed certain information. And, you know, you got a 24-hour shelf life maybe, but you could fake, you know, things and disseminate information and for whatever purpose. And we talked about that, and they all agreed, well, let's go down that road. And then I spoke with, you know, Mamet, and we began to talk it out on the phone, and it led to the shape of what's now WAG the Dog. So, you know, if you take the characters, you know, Dustin's character, the producer, wasn't, you know, part of, you know, the existing screenplay in the book, and how many of these things play out, and the idea of, you know, Nashville and faking music and faking merchandising and all of those kinds of scenarios that played out, and the Schumann character and all of that stuff is the invention of Mamet. And so that's how it took its shape. You know, it wasn't really saying that specific screenplay, you know, didn't work. It was just along a different line than what I think we were really, or what I was interested in going down, and then that led to this other piece.
Look, don't worry about it. It's nothing new.
See, once I think you're in sync about, you know, the style and the type of content that you want to approach, you know, then you feel confident enough, and, you know, and Mamet is a really fine writer. But he, you know, you're getting that on its feet. The story things he had to work out, you know, the story construction of those things, a number of those things he had to work out. But it was a shared, I think, sense of humor to how absurd the process has become in the last years of, you know, the 20th century. So that if you can say, look, let's look at Hollywood and let's look at the media, and let's look at the politics, and look how they're all blending into one in terms of how much manipulation can take place, and to the point that it has all become entwined, and what is real anymore? I mean, so therefore, if you talk about, you know, these ribbons and things, or is that a people movement, or was that basically, you know, instigated by certain people to create that groundswell as if it were coming from the people, but it wasn't? How much manipulation can work on what level? And I think that was the the level of cynicism and humor that we shared.
However, has emerged from the presidential quarter. We turn to Melissa Gardner at KZAB in Santa Fe with this breaking news. Melissa?
Thanks, Richard. Today, a local Firefly girl accused the president of sexual misconduct. This photo of the president with the girls was taken during their recent tour of the White House. The girl claims that the sexual misconduct occurred...
I always thought that it needed to be very driven, that the dialogue would be the action, in a sense that you had to move it in a way. It had to be in motion all the time. You didn't want to just sit there and take a kind of slow kind of rhythm to it, so that it was so constantly muscular and always in forward gear, in a sense, that you just, it's moving all the time. So they're talking very, very quickly. And my feeling is, you'll get the laughs that you get, and if you miss some, you miss some. And if you're in a theater and you lost a few of the laughs, then you'll come back again. But there's nothing worse than celebrating a laugh. Better that we enjoy it in its context rather than just celebrating a given laugh along the way. So the peace waits for no one.
Flat out, there is no B3 bomber. I understand.
If it is, Greg Nelson and I, we go back to acting school together in the late 60s. We used to do improvs together as part of the acting exercises, and we started doing, sort of like sketch pieces, like we were a comedy act. I mean, neither one of us wanted to do that, but we were able to make some money, so we would, the things that we would do in acting class, we would get up on a stage in front of some people and do material. I mean, I think about it today, it scares the hell out of me just to think about it, but we would get up there, and sometimes on a given late show, we would improv 45 minutes of material. So it's interesting. Craig wanted to act, and I was interested in writing, but we were both doing this comedy. But it was a very influential period in the late 60s where we were doing that stuff, kind of trying out things, and you start to find your way and see what begins to make sense for you.
Over 10 minutes to 10, the other side. Do I know you?
We have some mutual friends.
My name is Dustin Hoffman, and I was an actor in Wag the Dog. I played a producer by the name of Stanley Motz, but the T is silent. Moss, eventually Motz. I became involved with the Wag the Dog first through Jane Rosenthal and Bob De Niro at Tribeca. They knew I'm friends with Bob for years, and he just started directing. He knows I've been wanting to direct. So they are also a producing company, and they sent me this script called Bite the Bullet, from a novel called American Hero. And I read the script, and I didn't know how to do it, especially as a first directorial effort. It was much different from the movie that we know now as Wag the Dog. In that script, the whole film took place on a soundstage. But I thought there was something very interesting in it, so I sent it to my friend Barry Levinson, and I said, is there something here, or am I crazy? He says, no, I think there's something there. And it intrigued him.
That was the first day introducing, Stanley Moss, because we shot the bunker first, and then we moved on to that portion at the house, and in the tanning bed was, day one for Dustin. That was him getting that was Dustin getting his feet wet.
And right away when we were doing it, De Niro had that's in the script, can you call? But when we were rehearsing the first time, I realized that I have a desire to see who he's calling, because I know he works for the president, so I'm working as an actor thinking, this is a private thing, there was no lines. I think maybe I could find out the president's phone number if I look. So I looked, and Bob saw me doing that, and he pulls it away, so I can't look, so that at least is in the movie. It's just a small moment, but it's nice. But Barry comes up with the thing of saying, tell him to say that, and I said it, and then we saw back, because the guy had already filmed it, and we saw what he said, and I remember saying to Barry, so he's already said what I'm suggesting he say, but he's not saying it like I said it. And Barry said, well, and he starts to laugh, and he says, let's make that a part of the movie. So it's Barry's line that says, he didn't sell it. He didn't really sell it. See, it comes out of a real moment, that's it's glorious. That's people talk about when they, people that like the movie talk about that movie. I love when you did that thing. Tell them to say that, and our hopes and things are with you, our prayers and with you, Jehovah. And he didn't really sell it.
Prayers are with him.
I just want to say that I know that we are all concerned for the president, and that our hopes and prayers are with him.
Right. He didn't sell the line.
Thank you very much.
All actors work in a different way. Once he gets past the moment of, you know, of, I'm not, how am I going to do this, in that fear factor, and then he crosses that over, and then all of a sudden, all these kind of creative juices start, you know, taking over, and then you're really home free. So we've always had a very good understanding, and I think a shared sense of humor. So as we began to create this character, we could talk a lot about, you know, how does he function, etc.
When I was sitting in the first 2-3 days of shooting in the bathroom watching the television with De Niro and Han Haitian in the scene of the press conference, I was sitting in a certain kind of way. I didn't know why I was sitting in that way. It just has a certain kind of stature, sitting stature. And when I saw it, I said, that's my father. That's Harry. And then I realized I was really doing a lot of Harry. It's not the first time I did a lot of my father without realizing it at first, and then realizing it in Death of a Salesman. And that's just another side of him. When I worked with Olivier on Marathon Man, he said to me one time, I thought it was smart, sage comment. He says, you know, the dear boy. He said, just call me that. He said, the best of us don't have any more than 3 or 4 characters that are really pure characters. The rest are variations on the theme. And in a sense, we're doing the same thing over and over again, whether we know it or not. We're just kind of doing different shades. I mean, we're doing ourselves, but we all of us grow up doing our parents. I mean, we have aspects of our mother, aspect of our father, aspects of our grandparents, aspects of our those people that we were, you know, more and more when we were shooting that movie, I felt more than anything, including Salesman, anything I'd ever done, I felt there was my father was in this part the most of anything I've done. And afterwards, my brother just saw it a couple weeks ago, and called me up and said, my God, I didn't know you were doing Dad. That's the first thing out of his mouth.
Dustin starts, I think, now having done, you know, 4 movies with him, he begins with, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know who I am. I don't know who the character is. I can't do this role. That's where we sort of begin. You know, he's always said, you know, in Rain Man, after a week, he was ready to quit and saying, you know, you're going to have to get another actor. I don't know how to do this. I can't do this movie. I just don't know I don't know where the character is. Same thing with Stanley, you know. He kept saying, I don't know. I don't know who this is. I don't know how to do this, etc. And, you know, we just, rather than immediately, you know, creating a crisis like, oh, my God, what are we going to do? He said, oh, you know, we're going to get there. Of which I knew he was going to get there. I mean, first of all, this is not like some, you know, character that he has never come across in his whole life. You know, he's been in film business for over 30 years, so there's a basis of understanding, you know, many of the producers that he has met. But ultimately, I think as you go down that and he begins to take it on, you know, piece by piece, the character begins to make sense to him. That's how you shape the character, piece by piece by piece. There's not like one thing you say and it's all, you know, there. It's a lot of little discussions that you have in preparation for, you know, the day that you start, you know, filming. Or sometimes even in the first few days as he begins to see, you know, it all begins to make more sense to him. And, you know, we have that. Okay. And, you know, he gets there. But it's just this process. Every actor has a different way of, you know, of getting to the, you know, the starting line in a way. And, you know, there is no hard, fast rule about how to do it. Everybody comes at it in a different way. Some do it in a very quiet, introspective fashion. Sometimes some are much more vocal. You know, whatever. I mean, that's one of the things as a director, you got to find, you work with a lot of different, extremely talented people, and you got to find how to get the best from them.
I got the president on the line.
1 minute. Hey, 1 minute. DeMille, right? Needs an elephant for research.
Though I may have been doing my father, was also in, I'm sure, you know, partly it says, never wholly one thing or the other. I've always been impressed by producers. And not just producers, but executives. Sometimes affectionately and sometimes not so affectionately refer to as suits. Those people who aren't in the creative circle. They're not the director, they're not the cinematographer, they're not the writer or writers, they're not the actors. But they get in there somehow and they have their opinions. Especially when you're working on a screenplay. And sometimes they don't belong in the same room with the rest of us. Not that anyone can't have a good idea. But they have reminded me in the past of those students in school that always raised their hand before they knew the answer or even the question sometimes. It wasn't even half out. What do you think? And the hand was up because they wanted to be called on. And somehow they had the talent that by the time the teacher called on them, they were making up some, they were riffing, and I know the answer well, and you could see that, and they were just, they were operators. And they didn't have a clue. And they could tap dance verbally pretty good. And I think there's, anyone who's been doing movies knows that there's a lot of, more than a few producers that are like that. They have to, or even executives, they have to act like they know in order to keep their job. They feel they have to know. Not that they don't have their own talents in terms of marketing or putting things together or getting the money, but sometimes they want to feel that they can do it all. And sometimes that's not the case.
I want you to get Johnny a ticket, okay?
Fat King on two.
Okay. He's riding around in a pickup truck right now with a shotgun and a dog.
Are you shitting me?
I don't know what the process is to be honest with you. I mean, you start picking up, you know, more characters, and all of a sudden you're into a whole lot of people with a lot of different rhythms, all in a sequence, you know, together. And I think what you try to do is to it's along the same lines of its rhythm and how quickly it moves, dialogue-wise. And at the same time, not to inhibit the characters so that you are not taking advantage of any new line that may come up. And, you know, always be open to that. Because it's one of the things about film that differs, you know, from theater, is that sometimes you're bringing all these people together that haven't had 6-7 weeks of working it all out. So sometimes at a give and take, they may forget the line and say something else, and because that person said something else, this one now responds in a different way. And if it's going in a certain way, sometimes you'll discover moments which are interesting and work for the piece. And I think that we got lucky that happened between Dustin and Willie Nelson, because Dustin gave him the cartoon that says sit on my lap and around the insignia of the presidency. And what happened is he showed it to Willie, and I had said to Willie earlier on, if something comes up that you hear it sounds interesting, you can just sing it. I don't know, I just said it to him for some crazy reason. So when he saw that cartoon, he started going, sit on my lap if you love me, and put your hand down there, you know, and he did that, and Dustin trying to deal with him and saying something, and then it was sort of funny, and I said, look, there's something we can work on here. And as we did the additional coverage, we kind of built a whole, you know, way to allow that to work if it would hang together well enough and in the cut. But, you know, we just sort of built on it and, you know, made it connect in a certain fashion. And those things happen periodically if things are going well. And you don't want to go into a movie where you just have to get a lot of ad libs, you know, to make the movie work. But if you can find a few, because the script is very strong. It's a very strong, you know, script. But if you find an extra moment here and there, hey, try it out. And if it's no good, throw it out of the movie, and you've got your material, you know, as scripted to rely on. So periodically that happened, and that happened the very first day that we were shooting with the whole group.
People, huh? I like the sorrowful one.
What the hell is this again?
He lets me improvise. He lets you breathe. He lets you play what's not there. Like a fart in the phone booth in Rain Man. I like that. Let's do that. I farted, and Tom says, "Did you fart?" "Yeah, fart." I mean, that happened. I mean, most directors say, "Cut, cut, cut." Jesus Christ. Okay, cut. You know, I mean, take it when you can.
Jim.
Jim Belushi?
Jim Belushi what?
Albanian.
Jim Belushi's Albanian?
Surest thing you know. Are you kidding? Anybody know anybody who's ever eaten in an Albanian restaurant?
Is there such a thing as an Albanian restaurant?
Has to be. They have to eat.
Is it a national dish?
Well, nobody would know, right? We can make it up. So,
Mr.
Belushi
is Albanian.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, what happens here in this pool sequence is a find a way to sort of, in a sense, a signal that we don't have to stay on top of every piece of dialogue. It's almost like a bit of a relief. We've set up all of the talk, and then we needed a little bit of a breather, in a way. And so it seemed appropriate in a way, as a, you know, have Breen, he wants to fall asleep, and they're like talking, but we can't pay attention to every line because I think, you know, you just want a little rest. Your ear wants a little rest. So we kind of did this thing with slightly abstract, and the camera was underwater, and the images were all kind of blurred, and we knew that they were still working straight through the night to get certain things, you know, formulated. But that was kind of backing away from the dialogue and kind of make it almost, I wouldn't say dreamlike, but to back away, so we say, look, we don't have to pay attention to everything here. So that was creating a visuals that would say, okay, we're moving away a little bit here. Let's stay on top of it. It gives us a little bit of a break. And so you design something that has a different kind of visual, you know, look to it.
Change horses in midstream.
Why are they sticking with this age-old horse shit? Why?
And then the next scene, which comes up afterwards, when they're watching the commercial. You know, because they're watching the commercial, and Stanley hates that commercial and that whole thing, and they talk about being offended or whatever. And then that was another one of the sections where we got into a combination of ad-libs and then kind of worked out some stuff. So that's where Dennis Leary talks about he hasn't voted since Major League, you know, when Boog Powell, he voted for the All-Star game, he didn't get in, it turned him off to the voting process. And so what they all say in that sequence is a combination of just pure improv or discussing and finding some other little things to say about the fact that all of these people who are going to are so manipulative, on the other hand, don't vote. So it just came up while we were working on it, and I thought maybe there was something to explore here, and we kind of, you know, worked that out.
We got the
when I read the David Mamet script, I don't recall thinking, "Oh, this is a Romain Oclef on Clinton." It was never about Clinton. It was never the intention. It was always Barry has a hard on. All artists, I guess, have a certain agendas that they want to fulfill, and Barry's always had a desire to attack television. He's done it in earlier films of his. He did it in Avalon. He comes from the same generation that I do. We are the first television generation, and we are now witnessing maybe the fourth television generation.
In the second half of the 20th century, selling has become everything. We are inundated with, you know, commercials all the time with all these things that we need. We are sold all day long, every day. Never in the history of mankind has there been such a barrage of you know the selling of products. ever. So if the average person watches, you know, 5 or 6 hours of television today, that means they're watching at least an hour and a half of commercials. That's an hour and a half of, this is what you need. You need this, you need this, you need this, you need this. You ought to get this, you should get that, you should get this. An hour and a half a day. So, I mean, God knows what that does to us. Or whatever kind of anxieties it creates, because all day long is, gee, I don't have that. I should get that. I don't have that. And now you need a little help. I need Fred Astaire to help me to buy some kind of, you know, vacuum cleaner. I don't just need a vacuum cleaner. I need, you know, Fred Astaire to help me with a vacuum cleaner. And John Wayne's going to pick out some kind of beer. And, you know what I mean? And so it's there all the time. It's an extraordinary phenomenon. And it's less than 40 to 50 years old. So when someone says about, you know, well, don't you think you're being, you know, overly, critical of television? Because I've done several movies that deal with the issue of television and television and the influence on society. It's impossible to. It has played probably the biggest role in the second half of the 20th century. I don't think there's anything that's come along that has affected our lives as much as television. And what does it do? What are we now that we weren't before? How has it altered our understanding, how we relate to one another, in so many ways? I have no idea, but I know that it's astoundingly influential. And I grew up, you know, or I should say not grew up, I say at the age of 6, I saw it come into my house, you know, this box with a test pattern. And it's evolved into what it has today, and I've just been taken by how powerful it truly is.
Right there.
These are chips.
Yes. Just hold the bag when you run.
Sometimes the visual comes out of how you hear certain things, and how do you best support, you know, that work, and you hear it in your head, and that's the way you want to see it done. So when we would rehearse, we basically always worked so that we can get that kind of rhythm that it's almost, you don't want to get it so messy that all the lines are getting lost, but you want a certain precision that the lines are constantly, you know, almost overlapping one another, and sometimes where they can overlap, and it'll work to serve your purpose. I just thought this piece always seemed as if it needed that, because I didn't want it to become... you know, belabored in any way. I don't want us to be like celebrating any moment, and so therefore you just let it go, let it work. You know, it has a certain kind of, you know, fluidity, and at the same time, that's what a lot of times where the camera has to work. Certain scenes, you're basically framing it and letting all the dialogue happen within, and sometimes if you'd use the scene coming into the studio, the TV studio, which is basically a Steadicam, which is moving and picking up the conversations and, you know, between someone, and then it's going this, going over here, and is following that conversation, it's coming back over here, and they've got this conversation about the dogs, and so that one is much more of a kind of fluid way where all of the lines are coming and fading out and picking up other lines. Other times, sometimes you're framing it and letting all of those voices work within the frame.
You know, might be good as sirens.
What the hell is
when we're in the rooms looking at the cats and the things on the computers, that's the president. That was Barry's line. We're playing with the scene. Well, can I talk to him? Well, no, he's with the directing the Sixth Fleet or something. And he wants a what? And I'm doing like that scene very much. I remember doing my father. My father would do that. My father, he's not alive anymore, but he would have done that. The president is, he's telling me what kind of a color that dog should be. I mean, my father would feel that the president had no right to be getting into his business, his expertise. And Barry saw me doing that kind of, and it was Barry's line that he says, you know, I hate when they meddle. That's Barry at that moment. And it happened earlier in the scene when he tells me he wants to do the war. Don't get me started. I was playing off my father then. Tell him to wait is another spontaneous thing. Got the president on the phone. Well, wait a minute. And I said, let me tell you this story. My father would keep the president waiting. My father came and watched us doing The Graduate, and I was so afraid to have him there because I knew my father, and I kept trying to keep them from the set. It was like my first big movie, and we were at the Coconut Grove, and finally I said yes, they could come to the set. I said, this is all right, because I knew it was in a real hotel and there'd be a lot of other people that were watching, so we could just put him behind the yellow ribbon, and where he was standing with my mother and other people. And then I had to go to the bathroom. I went to the bathroom. I came back about 10 minutes later. It was a far to get to the bathroom, whatever. They took me, and I come back to the Coconut Grove, and Nichols takes me aside. He says, is your father always... I said, oh, God, what happened? And here's my first movie, and it's with the most famous, successful director of the time, Mike Nichols. He says, well, you were in the bathroom, and he was laughing. He says, we were laying some tracking. He and Bob Nichols and Sertz, he says, great cinematographer, decided to do it as a tracking shot. My father was watching. My father ducked underneath the yellow ribbon, went up to Nichols and said, you're not doing that shot right. He says, you shouldn't be doing it. You know, we had parents like that. And Nichols was laughing. He says, the camera should be here. And he just believed he knew. And that's why my father was perfect to use in this.
And this just in, a Newsbreak special report from the Albanian front. We've just received information that the young Albanian...
Everything that you see in the... at the television station, in the control room, you can do. You can't do it as quickly as we do it. Technology hasn't quite gotten to that yet, although it probably will in a few years even accelerate from the way they're doing it now. But you can do it as separate, elements. Take someone in an outfit, and then you'll put them in that, and you'll build onto it. I mean, that's all very feasible, I think, in a short period of time. So we do a little bit of a cheat, but not going to be that far off. Right now, it's the speed more than anything else. Can't be done as quickly as we do it. I find it a little frightening. Something about it, the idea that Fred Astaire now dances with vacuum cleaners and all these, dead movie stars are now coming back, to sell us products. Something that I personally am not in sync with, I guess.
Reports at this time from a reliable source that things are in motion. What I'm hearing, and this is a quote, the president is looking for a swift, painless, and victorious conclusion to the war. However,
the only way to really do, WAG is, we shot it very inexpensively in a very short time frame. And I think the benefit is that you can do a political comedy and you don't have to appeal to a big, wide, mainstream audience. That you'd say, look, at this particular price, we can have a certain portion of the audience and we'd be very happy with that portion because the economics will work out. As opposed to if you're thinking, well, you got to do $100 million, then you got to start to rethink it. Maybe you can't do this. Maybe this isn't acceptable. Maybe we got to, make the jokes a little more basic and some of the references a little more accessible. And then you start thinking of the movie in another way. So this was designed very specifically as a tight shoot in a very, by today's standards, the economics of it, a $15 million budget is being in a fairly low budget. This sort of created a certain energy in how we'd handle it. When you start shooting in 29 days and you're shooting sometimes 6-7 pages a day.
The breakdown and cry. Big Bird shrugs off his Secret Service, goes over to her, covers
in some way, a lot of this movie is a blur. We had to go so fast, we had 5 weeks of preparation, prep to get ready for it. So I worked at such speed that a lot of it just seems like a flash, racing around, seeing locations very quickly, talking about how we can handle some things and just sort of running and jumping into it. So it's the same way, like for instance, when we shot that scene in the limo when they get pulled over by the CIA, it's all that rain, so we were shooting on a Saturday, so it's going to rain. So, well, then hell with it. I'll just shoot in the rain. And if the rain stops, we'll get some kind of, you know, we'll get a garden hose and just squirt a little water, because we had no time and it just kept raining all day long. So we got nice production values, but, you know, we just had a shoot that was, we couldn't not shoot that day because we couldn't really make our dates that way.
I have this to say, especially.
Obviously, you know, Macy has worked with, you know, with David a lot, so I mean they have a good history with one another. It's nice. I mean, it only comes down to this. I mean, I'm a big fan of his work, and he's familiar with, you know, David's style of work, so it makes it a little bit easier. That's why it's great if you can work with people that you've used before, because you begin to develop a shorthand. You understand one another's moves, so you don't have to explain in the same way that you might with someone else. And so it's a little bit like, you know, you have certain friends and you have a certain kind of sense of humor. And it's like being with someone else and you got to explain the joke. That's a real hard road to go down with. You see why this is, you know what I mean? So, you know, Macy, you know, got it right away. And so therefore you're only working on the refinements of in terms of the performance. You might want to do a little of this, a little bit of that, or whatever, but, you know, it's there. So he was, you know, great to have. He only worked there one day.
That I am under medical care and taking medication, the side effects of which have rendered me a little
quite touching.
Well, I also take this opportunity to suggest that equally, I admit to nothing, and I would like my lawyer present.
We show, and NSA confirms, there are no nuclear devices on the Canadian border. There are no nuclear devices in Albania. Albania has no nuclear capacity. Our spies...
We were going to have a reading of the screenplay, and I thought, well, maybe we ought to try Ames as a woman. I don't know. I just came into my head, you know, and I talked to David. I said, look, I'm thinking that just try her as a... Try Ames as a woman and see. He said, well, that's kind of interesting. So we had the reading, and Anne Heche came in and read that role, and she was terrific in reading it. Not only in showing that it would work that way, but she was also the perfect person to do it. So it was one of those things of you get something in your head in terms of some instinct, and you go with it, and I think it served the piece.
Oh, what, are they useless? Are they just broke, or what?
I mean,
what
is... I would like to point out further that these medications, I mean, taken in conjunction...
If there's no threat, then where are you? Let me go you one more. If there's no threat, what good are you?
Mr. Breen, you are the threat.
I'm the threat.
A lot of comedies have a tendency to kind of lighten up the room a lot, you know, as if, like, you can't get a laugh unless it's all very, you know, lit up. This, in a sense, kind of works against that and goes the opposite direction and say, look, you know, it's almost... You know, a little more dramatic than it should have been, perhaps, periodically. Because, I mean, one of the things which I've never been fond of is I don't like when the visual becomes so dominant that it actually distracts and it becomes its own kind of, you know, celebration of, you know, look how acrobatic we can be. I think you never want to sense that the camera is doing anything other than presenting you with the information. You don't want it to be dull in any way, but I think you always want to hide how the camera is working or where it is, so that you're not aware of it, unless you want to go back and check and notice, oh, this is kind of interesting, they were doing this at that particular time, but not to the fact that it gets in front of and becomes a, you know, the star in its own right. I think you only want to see that in repeated viewings on, you know, video where you can examine things. But I think it has to, the visual has to be, you know, part of you know, the work, that it all meshes together and nothing stands out other than, you know, the piece.
I don't see nothing. If there ain't no war, then you can go home and prematurely take up golf, my friend. Because there ain't...
It's very hard to define the look of something. I always said to Bob Richardson, we were doing it, I think it's a ragged elegance that we're sort of looking for in this movie. We're never going to be a documentary because we're not a documentary. But if we can borrow just a little bit of that, you know, so we got a teeny bit of this kind of raggedness and, you know, sort of that was the basis of sort of, you know, mounting, you know, the visual approach to the piece. So at times it seems as if the camera is trying to catch, you know, the information that's taking place when in fact, you know, we always know what's going to take place, but you want it to seem unpredictable. And then in terms of the lighting, for it to be sometimes very dramatic, almost maybe more dramatic than it should be periodically. You know, we use a lot of dark, very, very dark areas. You know, we let the light fall away. And the faces are really, you know, up front as if it's very kind of dark at times. And at the same time, I think you have to find the color palette so that we don't want it to become, you know, like a super technicolor kind of a thing, but yet we're not afraid of color periodically. So there you do see, you know, Ames wearing red on an occasion, or Bob has got that red, you know, sweater that he wears. So this color jumps out periodically so that it's using the color for effect at certain times, so that you wouldn't look at it as being, you know, one of those real, you know, as I say, technicolor kind of movies, but not to mute the palette so much that it's really devoid of it. It's really a choosing the time and place where you want that color to jump out a little bit.
Our forefathers earned the right to be free.
Well, I mean, you wanted to find some kind of something that, you know, Moss was up to in terms of music, that you can see where he was going with this. Yeah, he was about to launch a record that would have a whole patriotic flavor, and you want it to sort of resonate a little bit close enough to, gee, that's kind of like, didn't they do something like that or whatever, you know? And so we were able to put together that type of a piece. And it was also nice in the sense because it came at a right time, because suddenly a little bit of music comes into the piece. And again, you want to find these little islands where you can get away from, you know, the, you know, wall-to-wall dialogue. So you get a little bit of a break with that.
I laughed when I saw it. I, again, was trying to work correctly as an actor. And I wasn't trying to be funny. I wasn't trying to satirize. I have been, on occasion, in sound rooms when music has been going on, and it's one of the biggest kicks I've ever had. I like it better than any ride at an amusement park, to just hear an orchestra recording as it, and them going over it again. I just have, because I grew up wanting to be a piano player, you know, music is close to me, I guess. And to pretend like you're conducting is a great feeling. And when Barry asked me to do that, I wasn't acting. I mean, you don't try to act. You don't want to act. You want to get, I mean, ultimately, you just want to do it. And then if you do it well, the object is to get caught naked. And I guess that's one of the easiest scenes I had in the movie. I certainly didn't have to memorize any lines, but that anybody that knows me knows that that's one of the, you know.
What does he mean the situation has been resolved?
He just ended the war.
He ended the war?
Why did he have to go and do that?
I think the CIA just cut a better deal.
He ended the war?
As the innocence of a child. Nothing.
He can't end the war. He's not producing this.
See, what I like about the movie overall is that it keeps upping the stakes of absurdity. Because you start on this level, now you've added this element to it, but now you got this whole group doing this, you know, this song, and then ultimately that they'll be found out. Now that's no good. Now you got to up it to this level. They're constantly on to something new. They don't work one idea all the way through the movie. They're ultimately finding another way and another way to, you know, con the American public. And I thought this was an interesting, you know, place to go. And then they start to hit bottom when they think that, you know, they've been found out, and now where do they go from there? And then we go into that duet, which I thought was quite interesting, with Willie Nelson and Pop Staples.
I heard before. No, the war isn't over till I say it's over. Okay,
this is my. For me, when, you know, we all agreed to work together, and then the script was written, and we had the reading in Los Angeles. It was my turn in the barrel. They had a full cast of actors, some that are in the movie, some didn't didn't wind up in the film. But De Niro was there. De Niro couldn't get through the script because he's laughing so hard. Loved it so much. And I'm sitting there not knowing what I'm doing. Barry had assigned the parts. He said to Bob, you're playing that part, and told me I'm playing this part. And I was put off right at the beginning. Sometimes that happens to me. Because in the draft that I was given, in the first scene that he has, which didn't wind up in the film, he's sitting. The producer's sitting poolside, like at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and he's kind of overweight. It says, and he's kind of bald. This was an image that Mammoth had, you know, kind of a cigar in his mouth. I thought, oh man, I can't do this. You know, I don't let him get someone else. I always tend to have an aversion of doing that which rings familiar to myself. It's a thing that disturbs me. And Barry turned to me in that reading, and you know, I've known him for years. He was angry. I'd never seen him angry at me before. And he said, you're really screwing up this reading, man. I said, why? And he whispered to me when the other actors are talking. He says, well, you're not doing anything. I said, I don't know what to do. He says, well, just talk louder and faster. And which I did, but, you know, I was very unhappy, and we gave each other kind of dirty looks at the end. And I said, well, I'll see you later. And he wanted to stick around and talk, and I just wanted to get out of there. I didn't want to do it. I just felt, what have I gotten myself into? And I went home, and I talked to my wife, and I tried to get out of it. And the next thing, they wanted a conference call. And there's De Niro in New York, and I'm in L.A., and Barry's in San Francisco. We're all on a conference call, and next thing I know, De Niro is screaming like he's doing something out of Goodfellas. And he's telling me, you know, you gotta do this, M.M. Bowman, you gotta, what do you mean, you don't want to, we're all partners. And, you know, he's doing a character. I'm listening, and he said, what do you want? He says, I'll play your part. You play my part. And I says, no, it's not about that. I'm tired. Maybe that's it. I just don't want to work. Please, you're plenty of good actors that, you know, you can get to do it. And it was a terrible conversation. Because I've always felt that you shouldn't work unless you feel you can do good work. It's the worst thing to do is to not to be fired. The worst thing is to do bad work. I had a separate phone call with Barry, and we had a talk, and he said, I'll make you a deal. I said, what? He said, don't do anything. I said, well, that's what I was doing at the reading. And he got mad. And he says, just let's go back to that. And that's Barry's genius. And we started, I said, okay, I'll do it. He says, just forget, no demands on you. Nothing. Don't worry about the character. Forget it. It was half as good and true.
Hey, they keep me. Anybody here know Morse code?
What are you going to do with Morse code?
Give me the facts. Sergeant William Schuman, U.S. Army, serial number 21312841262.
Good old shoes. Here's the deal.
Good old shoes.
Again, it's almost as if the camera is sort of discovering the two of them, and the way the camera sort of meanders around as they put that song together. As a kind of a stylistic way to do it, rather than, you know, like sort of a real planned shot that looks like it creeps over and, you know, Willie a point, you know, because one of the things is I didn't want them to rehearse that much, therefore they'll know the song too well. So I wanted them to be learning it and then shooting it at that point in time, so you can see that they're actually exchanging a little musical information with one another, so that it had a real freshness to it.
Stand up straight and tall the way he taught you to.
I'll write a speech.
I'll help you with the speech.
The president reveals that William Schuman, was trapped behind enemy lines.
This is good.
Heartfelt.
Touching.
Oh, people will weep.
Heaven, the soul of a good old shoe.
What happened was we filmed in the daytime. We took a break for evening. Went to this restaurant that was in a hotel. Can't remember the name of the restaurant.
All right, here's a speech.
And while we were in there, Congress right away. We found out that the president was having some kind of fundraiser. And this woman came and said, would you like to meet the president? We said, fine. And we got up, and we were in the back room at this restaurant. We went through the restaurant and through the lobby and through some halls and down some things. And, you know, it was a large hotel. And we finally got to some doors. She says, I'll be back in a minute. She came back. She disappeared. 2-3 minutes later, someone else comes out and says, can I help you? So we were here to meet the president. And this is, you know, De Niro and, you know, Dustin, Ann, myself, and a few other people. And she said, to meet the president's very busy. He's in a fundraiser. Well, someone said to come here, whatever. And then there's a confusion. We said, back with it. So we all just leave. We go back through the lobby, the thing, back down into the restaurant, into the back room, and we're eating. And then about 5 minutes later, the woman who originally came, you know, walks up and says, I am so sorry. There was some kind of confusion and whatever. And this other woman didn't understand. And De Niro's sitting at the head of the table. And she says, would you still like to meet the president? And Bob looked at her. He's very quiet. He went, will he meet us halfway? And she looked at him because he looked, you know, very kind of serious. And then took her beat. And then she went, oh, you're just kidding. I did. And so she said, let's go. We get up. We go through the thing, et cetera, down the hall, through the whole thing again. And Secret Service, and, you know, we get in, searched and whatever. And we meet the president finally in some room. And we talk and hello, and everybody shakes hands and everything else. And he said, so what are you doing here? We said, well, we're making a movie. And he said, what is it about? And at that moment, there was a kind of like awkward beat. And De Niro looked at me, and I kind of looked at him, and we looked over at Dustin. And then Dustin said, well, it's a story about, and then he went on and made up a movie that we've never heard of.
And I just took off, and it's 12 o'clock at night, and Barry later told me that I did about a 10-minute monologue that had nothing to do with the film, and I was talking about the media and Reagan and this and that and the other, because it did go through my brain when they all looked at me. I could start saying, well, he's accused of molesting a Girl Scout in the Oval Office, and, you know, to kind of just give a quick linear. And then the minute that went through my brain like a on Times Square, you know, the news, you know, goes on a building, I just kind of said, no, I don't think I'm going to say that to this man. And then it was, you know, it got very theoretical. I don't have a clue. I really wish him well. I love what's happened. It's terrific. I mean, I love the way the American public has responded to all this. It's quite wonderful. In the sense that they won't have it. It was groundbreaking. I mean, this is all, you know, it's changed a lot of things. I mean, to have Gary Hart thrown out of the race, and the next thing you turn around, there's a guy by name Clinton running for office, and there he is sitting with his wife while he's running and admitting to some kind of affairs, but he's not going to talk about it, and we elect him. And up to then, we would never elect a president. We had to believe that they had a perfect marriage and God-fearing and went to church and had a dog and kids. Boom, 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 boom. Then we got to a point where we didn't have to believe that, but we had to believe that at least they had that Saturday Evening Post Norman Rockwell image of that, that they could deliver the image of it. That was important. Just give us an image that we can sell to the other countries. And now, with the election of Clinton, we moved to the point where we said, okay, you know, so what else is new? Run the country. I guess starting with Jack Kennedy, we knew we could elect a president basically by having him present an image on television which was attractive enough that the issues became secondary. It has gotten to a point where the media has now determined the way the administration is going to behave, and that was the thing that we were trying to satirize in Wag the Dog, that the tail would be wagging the dog. Decisions would be made based on how a public is, and it And we were, and Mamet was taken taking it from fact. Yes, what he was says in the screenplay through De Niro. Was it a coincidence that George Bush invaded, you know, created the Desert Storm, or was a part of pushing through Desert Storm, partially to get rid of the wimp factor, which was plaguing him in his presidency? He wouldn't have a chance to be reelected. If anything is going to elect a president, then he must have a war. It was that kind of, I'm not saying it very good, but that's that kind of a thing that was always behind that movie. That was the primary thing. Clinton, it was just something to use. A president with a healthy libido. He certainly wasn't the first. It's just timing. In order for television news, the so-called legitimate television news, to compete, they have to run with stories before. In President's Men, we said Jason Robards, as Ben Bradley says, get two sources or you can't run with it. Well, today you run with it. So that's what this movie was always meant to be. We got criticisms on Wag the Dog from some reviewers, primarily in Washington, D.C. Far be it from anyone who doesn't live in Washington satirize them besides them. So we got most of our negative reviews from the film critics in Washington, and one of the things they said over and over again is, and this is prior to the Monica Lewinsky thing breaking, this isn't news, this doesn't tell us anything we don't know. Then we were accused of going back and reshooting after the Monica Lewinsky thing broke, which of course we didn't do, and it's just some kind of who knows what it is. I mean, but he's kissing a girl in your movie and she's got a beret. Well, sorry, the film was out before that ever broke. We didn't know it.
Willie Schuman remains missing behind enemy lines.
It's all, you know.
I remember in the limo as being the last, that was the last night of filming. Because we went to Washington, D.C. So the two of them in the back of the limousine was the last night of filming, the last hours of filming. Finish somewhere around 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. So I think that they probably were as together as they were ever going to be, in a way, which was appropriate to the piece, if anyone can spot that in any way, because they were so in sync at that point in time. In terms of, you know, reacting and sharing a sense of humor and, you know, how they viewed everything. Because we were only in Washington for one day, and we did all that stuff in one day. We ran around like crazy and met the president on the dinner break by accident. But that was that one day in Washington, D.C.
And the throwing away of the old shoes. I mean, who steps up some pages for that? You throw away the old shoes. What are you going to do? You buy new ones.
We have some very powerful new friends at the International Association of Shoe Manufacturers.
Jeez, you guys sure get around.
Oh, Fat King is my hero. Want to go first?
Sure.
It's the Riccani.
Yeah, so here you've got, you know, shoes being thrown up on, you know, the poles for old shoe and whatever, and like supposedly, you know, and high school students doing like that. So how do you know there wasn't like a few people planted at the high school game to throw the tennis shoes on there and then other people join in? How much manipulation is at work out there? I think that was, it's part of the fun of WAG.
Go on, tell your friend.
Well, this is interesting. I have just been handed this, something I just discovered, a 1930s recording, part of the folk song collection of the Library of Congress, and a fitting song, if I may say so, about Schumann. You know, Schumann is the military soldier who's been left behind enemy lines.
Jim, could I get a word with you, please? Would you like to comment on the situation in Albania?
We brought in some of the TV people, like Leno, Jim Belushi. You know, a few of those, you know, because it seemed appropriate enough to the film. That you want to have a certain kind of credibility. Not that you need all of the news people to be, you know, ultimately supporting that. just a little flavor here and there that is all you really kind of need. You know, I think what happens is if you have the late show host Bob Bilerman, it's suddenly go, who, what, you know what I mean? You got to begin to think about that as opposed to say, Leno, oh, okay, I got it. And it just simplifies it rather than adding some kind of artificial name, etc. Because, you know, we're mentioning names of places and that, which are obviously real. So you want to keep just enough of that so that it seems credible.
The Polish lady.
Yeah, White House wants to know about the Congressional Medal of Honor.
What about it?
Presuming.
Well, wait a minute. We got 86% in favor. We bring him back tomorrow. The charts go up. They don't go down. I mean, I don't want to tell them how to do their business. But
I mean, you have to create enough credibility in the piece that you're doing that you are not going to go, well, as a tone too naughty, I'm not going to pay attention. It has to be credible enough that it holds you in place and it holds your interest. No matter how nutty it may be, you've got to find within it its own kind of level of credibility. Preposterous, insane, or whatever, and yet it makes sense and is credible unto itself. You know what I mean? Not in relationship to another thing, but unto itself, it has to have a certain kind of, you know, credibility. I think and even within that, there are certain things you go, well, that doesn't work. That doesn't make sense to this speech, which is already absurd in a certain level and is cynical and etc. It has to basically fit those pieces. And so each thing that you work on has to have its own kind of credibility. And, you know, the news has its own kind of, you know, credibility within its structure that it works with. And that's part of, at times, why we can be duped, because sometimes some people seem so credible, it must be true, and it may not be true. That's a very hard, you know, game. You know, it's like you think you're always going to find the snake oil salesman, you know, but you don't really know. You know, you could be faked out, and it may take a little bit of time until you find out that is altogether wrong, and that person really didn't know whatever, but it's very hard to know. So
over the country as the American people continue to show their patriotism.
You ought to get
Barry Levinson and I met on Rain Man. I had been with the project for about 2 years, gone through different directors. I felt very close to it, as I have felt about certain projects I've done in my life. I had done as much research as I could do, and was so shocked when Barry came in as a last minute director, and with only like 6 weeks before we were going to start shooting, or we were going to lose crews, and understood something that it took me 2 years to understand. I've never understood it. I never could figure it out. And worked in the same way that I like to work. One of the big problems with making movies is that there's always a committee involved because of studios put up money and everything, and they all, more and more, so many suits have a point of view, and they throw out the kind of jargon that on every movie, the same jargon. Well, you need more jeopardy, and you need this, and you need that, and you got to have an arc. I mean, they hear these words that that are used sometimes by people who know what they're talking about, and they throw them out. And to give an example, I never understood why the Cruise character didn't catch a plane after he kidnapped his brother, because he was a very ambitious, opportunistic and probably devious individual at the beginning of the movie. That's why they have that scene of him with the cars, and you know, he'll do anything for a deal. He's the next, you know, next just a notch above being a used car dealer. And why would he then kidnap his brother and go cross country in a car? Why wouldn't he get on a plane? So whenever that was brought up, in the year and a half I was with the project, either with earlier directors or writers or studio people, they'd look at me like I was crazy, and they would say, well, if you don't have a if you get on a plane, you don't have a movie, like, you know. Really? Well, yes, this movie is basically two guys in a car. Really? And I come from the school that Barry comes from, and that Tom too could appreciate, which is, well, let's just go to the airport, because that's what Tom says I would do. So we sit there working on the script, and we go to the airport. Now, how do we not get on the plane? Because, yes, they're right, if we get on the plane, either it has to crash somewhere, which is what would wag, or, you know, we don't have a movie. We have to be in the car. So now what happens? And that's the way you work. And you put the audience, I think, you best serve your audience, allowing them the intelligence, to use the intelligence they have. You know, you dramatically put it on in front of them on the screen. Find a reason why we can't get on the plane. And Barry found it and wrote that scene about Qantas. And that's just an example of him understanding. And ever since then, I always felt I was lucky enough to find. I always felt, gee whiz, De Niro's got Scorsese and Brando had Kazan. What are you going to do after this? Spielberg and Harrison Ford or whatever. I never had the luck to. And then I found Barry, and his wife was pregnant during Rain Man, and my wife wound up being the midwife. So they're now best friends. So it's just, you know, one of those things.
Why, if I was asked?
Well, I mean, I don't know where over the top is in a certain respect, because, you know, as crazy as things are, we always find something which is even more insane. So it's very hard to say you can get over the top. I do think you have to keep upping the stakes at some point. It has to reach a point of, you know, of on the verge of absolute madness. Otherwise, I think you stay just below it and you stay kind of, you know, maybe a little bit too polite to it all. And if you think of some of them, I mean, the end of Strangelove, the guy's actually riding the bomb, you know, with a hat. You know, going, you know, yippee-yi-yay or whatever it is, riding the bomb. Or if you take a look at, you know, Network, when it gets completely wild there at the very end, you know, just that they have the assassin killing the guy on the air and the whole thing. I mean, it just gets completely, you know, wild. I think at some point you have to basically be brave enough to step up to the complete madness of it all, of where it's all going. Or you stay in some level. That might just ultimately be a little too polite to the piece.
Well, that's fine. People are waiting for
him. Yeah.
Child at the airport breaks it.
We're talking about madness in the end. You know, these things are totally insane. And at some point, I think you ultimately have to you'll spin out to some kind of, you know, conclusion along those lines. Because you just keep building on one thing is a little crazier than the next thing. So you say, well, the fact is that they went to get a war hero. They went to get a war hero. They want to get somebody who can play a war hero. They pick a picture of a guy who looks like he should be a war hero with Woody Harrelson. The fact that the guy is a complete psychotic, you know what I mean, is consistent, you know, in my mind. You get a psychotic, okay, so you'll drug him and you'll do whatever because he looks like a war hero, which ultimately, again, is the image. It is the image that is all. Schumann looks like he could be a war hero from the pictures that they saw. In fact, they say it looks like perfect casting. So, you know, looks like an American guy, you know, he's, you know, looks like a real American. So the fact that he's a complete lunatic doesn't make any difference to him. He looks like he could be a hero. And that's what's important. And so to me, that there's the consistency, the fact that the plane will crash, you know, the guy, you know, the plane has crashed, all these things are going haywire, they'll move to the next particular step, and they'll keep moving to the step. The fact that the war hero gets killed, you know, literally trying to rape some girl, whatever. So, and as they say, what is better than a war hero? A dead war hero is even better. I mean, it's all in its own kind of logic, upping the stakes of complete madness, culminating with the fact that a guy wants the credit for what he's done, and therefore, then they'll kill him. You know, they'll do whatever they need to do to play that particular game. So to me, it's consistent. It gets more and more crazy as things keep happening, you know, in our lives and what we have seen take place. There was a time when you would think some of these things in life would never take place, and yet they do now, and we accept it. We move on to the next thing. And I think the level of madness keeps accelerating, certainly as we're concluding this 20th century.
We're trying to do this thing.
Yeah, well, as long as you get me back for the beans.
For the beans, yes.
Today a story is somebody has a gun and they're coming to kill you. That's a story. And interestingly enough, in some of the movies I've done in the past, they'll say, you know, if you take some... Well, I don't know what the story was. You know what I mean? I remember seeing that, like, you know, when Diner or Avalon or something. I don't know what the story was. However, if it's like the person has a gun coming to kill you, then they know the story. Because then they know the specific, as opposed to looking and interpreting and making sense out of what is being presented to you. They just want to know exactly that. And I think that's... an audience doesn't quite work as much... Or as much as I think that they should, perhaps. Which I think in some ways is scary.
I'm going to need an ambulance.
I think that there's some people who would assume that you can't have a movie without real relationships. And that ultimately is sort of, I think, part of the way it plays out. Is that, you know, that Ames doesn't have some kind of relationship, you know, with, you know, Breen. Any kind of sexual relationship, anything other than the fact that they are there working together at this particular time and place. And I think that, you know, Stanley and Breen, their relationship is ultimately one of, I think, of respect at a certain point, but nothing really beyond that. They may have a degree of affection on a certain kind of level that's there, but you try not to make any real relationships connect. There is no kind of other history, past things, etc. The movie is devoid of that, and intentionally so. It plays on another kind of level. And so therefore someone may say, well, you know, you gotta have relationships or whatever. Maybe you do on certain kinds of movies. And you should, obviously, on a lot of films, because actually we're in a crazy kind of world today, because a lot of movies, the relationships are so kind of cockeyed, because you've got these kind of rather action kind of, you know, pinball movies. But and we don't really explore a lot of relationships on a real level on a number of films. But this one, we're not intentionally involving ourselves with it. We step outside of that, that these characters do not have any kind of real relationship other than the ideology and the agenda that needs to be played out.
Just calm down.
So there is no morality. I don't think there's any morality to anything that anyone looks at. They look at what do you need to do to accomplish your goals. Period. And anything that accomplishes those goals and basically preserves what they think is the correct structure is necessary.
Waiting for his plane to land at Andrews Air Force Base, a plane that is due to land, long overdue.
The president is monitoring the situation personally and closely, and we will keep you updated as to any developments. Thank you very much.
Oh, God.
I don't think we've seen many satires, period, in American film. It's not a real genre that's played out. Very few satires are really done in American film. I mean, in American films, you can go back to Strange Love and Network, you know, two that come to mind. And then the English ones, you have the Mouse That Roared and perhaps the Man in the White Suit, and a couple I can't quite, you know, remember, you know, but they come with a certain amount of dignity in the way that they move about, rather than just being buffoons. This is like this certain amount of dignity, and they run into all the absurdities that are all part of, you know, life. So I was always kind of quite taken by this. There's very small English comedies that were made in the early 50s that truly used to amuse me. They were very small kinds of moments, but they really made me laugh in the way that they would show the absurdity that was going on in a fairly dignified manner. And I got a kick out of that.
Exercise, because I know it's my day in the yard.
Get him out to the highway.
You think this is tough? Come on, pal.
This is nothing.
Albanian dissidents.
I think satire, for one, is rather fragile in a way. You know, I think real kind of basic kind of comedy is more of a tradition in a way. Real basic kind of stuff, you know. You know, you step on a board, it hits you in the head. You know what I mean? Satire basically means that you have to know certain elements of things that are taking place in society and then turn them slightly to make fun of them. And so it requires a certain amount of understanding. And therefore you got to basically be involved in a certain way. And too many people are just, you know, too lazy, I think. And I think that satire by nature always comes under a rather close scrutiny by, you know, critics as well. So it's very hard to kind of maneuver through that world, because they'll say, well, it didn't go far enough. I don't think it totally explored, you know what I mean, and all of the things that come with it, some of which may be valid, but you're playing it at such a standard that it makes it very difficult. And whereas if you just made a movie where you just keep banging into the wall or whatever, the critic is going to be much easier. So it's hard to navigate that kind of, you know, critical, you know, world. I mean, WAG was very lucky that we did, but boy, you know, sometimes they can just, you can get your heads chopped off very quickly. And it's a much more delicate form. I think it's probably more risky in terms of the today's world of trying to sell it and the marketing, etc.
Whether or not enemy action.
I'm fine, I got it.
Good satire, it needs to be based on enough elements going on in life and then accelerating it to some other place. Because I don't think you can just simply dabble in a few of the absurdities that are taking place today. I think it's got to kind of move it to some other place ultimately, a la Strangelove or Network. I mean, what Chayefsky was talking about, Network, at one point people said, this is totally crazy. You're going to end up with those kinds of crazy shows on the air, you know? And now those shows are looking very much like the shows that are on television. So at one point some people would say, he's gone too far. It was too crazy. And it actually came to be. That, I think, is good satire. When it doesn't just sort of, you know, dabble in a few of the craziness things that are going on in society, but it actually takes a point of view and takes it somewhere else. We don't ever have to get to that other place, but I think we got to say, if this can happen, maybe it'll go this wild. And I think that's part of what makes it interesting. And I guess, you know, you're playing a dangerous game in a way. Because, you know, you've got to have a certain amount of information, you know, to come to the piece. You know what I mean? You don't have to have a great understanding of politics to watch Wag the Dog, but you have to have at least some kind of interest in something that's going on in life. You know what I mean? As opposed to, say, you know, Con Air. You don't have to have any kind of connection to anything. It exists in, you know, in another place entirely. So somehow you need a little bit of, have some connection to what is going on to want to explore this. Even though we don't know anything about their lives, we don't know anything about Stanley, is he married or whatever, or Breen or Ames, or Ames only mentions one thing about a, like a child at one point. It's about as much as we ever give away. Otherwise, their lives are complete mystery. We get little pieces of information about them, very, very slight. And we connect to them, and as devious as they may be, we sort of get caught up in that. Because there are no good guys in the piece. You know, it's all bad guys. There is no villain. They are, you know, the villains to the piece. It's not good versus evil in any way. It's that. I mean, so it is an odd piece that you have no relationships and you have no heroes. And yet that's, in a sense, is the way that it has to function.
Wait a minute, now.
I have a relationship. Shoe,
you want to talk to me? Anything you want. So if you want some beans, how will I do it, Schuster?
Shoe, come on, Shoe. Any kind, remember that? Oh, God, he's dead. Oh, my God. Oh, my. Oh. Oh, wait a minute, he's not dead. Strike that.
Well, I mean, you can always consider an alternative ending if you wanted the piece to be nicer. You know, or a little sweeter, so you don't kill the guy, you know. Ultimately, it's consistent, you know, with something which was rather subversive, that you have to contain the information. You know, someone is going to go public with the information of an incredibly subversive event. What are you going to do? Let them go talk? Or at some point, you know, get rid of them. So it makes perfect sense to kill them, because just another person might have been very good at what he did, but they're finished with that. So if this person were to go public with it, better to be dead than to have that kind of, you know, exposure. So that's the less commercial way to go, probably, in terms of killing him. The nicer way to go is that he'd be, you know, he's a, you know, ambassador to, you know, to Jamaica. And he's in Jamaica and he's out by the pool and whatever, and then you kind of have a joke to go out on, as opposed to maybe something which is, I think, more consistent with the movie, that they'll do whatever they need to do to accomplish their goals. So there is no morality. I don't think there's any morality to anything that anyone looks at. They look at, what do you need to do to accomplish your goals? Period. And anything that accomplishes those goals and basically preserves what they think is the correct structure is necessary.
Coffee? I was having a lot of trouble when I look out there and say, this is the most honest thing I've ever done, is I see the berets and the musicians or the soldiers. And Barry wanted that moment, just, you know, it's the most honest thing I've ever done. And Barry's a very good actor, and that always makes for a good actor's director. When a director has not been an actor, you know it right away. It's like a man telling a woman, I know exactly what it feels like to be a woman. You don't, unless you've been there. And when a director has been an actor, he's been there, so when you're having trouble, they understand it, and they can help you through it. Because sometimes it's a mystery why you can't do something. And that was a tough moment. I knew what Barry wanted intellectually, and I wasn't able to quite give him what he wanted. I don't know if I ever got it. Sometimes you just wind up, they say, well, that's the best of the 30 takes. But we did a lot, and he just wanted me to center it as close as I could to the, you know, I guess the most personal side of myself. And that's what he was after. The last thing was particularly difficult because I was trying to find the balance of it. Also, David Mamet visited the set that day, and it really shook me up. Not the set, that was a location. But I looked up and suddenly Mamet said, oh, shit. And that was the scene with De Niro where I said, I want the credit. And again, I was screwing up the lines, leaving, you know, you do it well, and you realize the script supervisor comes up to you, you feel, man, that was a good take, that felt good. Well, you left this line out, you know, and you can't do that with Mamet. So I think the balance of, Barry was after something, which was to be angry was all right, but it was I can't remember. It was all I know is I wasn't doing it right.
I did this, I did that, I did the costumes, I did this thing, I did that thing. And Barry really stayed with me on that.
Stanley, you knew about that, Stanley.
What?
Said, you knew the deal when you signed
up. Oh, come on. Deals change.
No. Let's rethink.
Sure it is.
Listen to me.
What?
Let's rethink that ambassadorship. I'm talking London, I'm talking Paris, I'm talking a secret account for your extra expenses, getting laid whenever you want, Marine guards will salute you all the time.
No, it's tempting, but I got to answer to a higher calling. Art.
Oh, money? Okay. Oh,
money. You think I did this for money? I did this for credit.
But you always...
For credit.
I think it's good writing for Mamet K, that character. In a way, there's a sense... They used to say that Mamet had a... was carrying the standard, the baton from Arthur Miller. Arthur Miller wrote Death of a Salesman. Now, one could say there's a similarity between Willy Loman and Stanley Motz, so they're two different people. Willy Loman had the opportunity to play them both. Willy Loman chooses suicide at the end so he can leave something to his kids. He'll get the insurance money. He will be successful for the first time in his life. Stanley Motz commits another kind of suicide, though he doesn't know they're going to kill him, because he, too, wants to be thought of successful. He's never gotten, as he says, the credit. If that's a fatal flaw, it certainly was for Willy Loman. He wanted the credit. He, in his own mind, never could compete with Dave Singleton, who, when he died, thousands of people came to his funeral, as he says in the play. And Stanley Motz, though he's successful, he has never won an Oscar. And that, for him, is the... It plagues him all through his life. His professional life. He has never gotten the credit, as he puts it. Arthur Miller wrote in a, or said in an interview around the time of Death of a Salesman, and I wish I could remember it exactly, but he said it was wonderful the way he phrased it. He said, everyone, he was talking about, and I guess what I'm saying is, what he was saying is that it is everyone's fatal flaw, because in some way we all want the credit. That's part of the feeling of being human, is the constancy of feeling insignificant, never really getting away from that feeling. No matter how successful someone could be or loved, but love will take you closer, I think, to not feeling insignificant and successful. And as Arthur put it, are we all not like a hot cake of ice? He said, isn't success, oh, that's what he was saying, this need to be successful is so ultimately so futile, because it the need supplants the need to be successful fills in the lack of love that one has in one's life. And is being successful ultimately nothing more than carving your name on a cake of ice on a hot July day? It's a great line. It's a great image. We all want everyone to know of our incredible worth. And anyone who's been a parent sees how it's such a fundamental part of being human.
We'll be sending planes and troops back in to finish the job.
Now you can do a woolly bully. What can you pull the woolly woolly? Can you? you wag? Can you wag the dog?
I think today, because you've got so many outlets now, so many news outlets, that sometimes they will immediately just grab, you know, a piece of information that comes across, and then they'll broadcast it, and it's unverified, and ultimately, you know, the truth may come out in 24 hours, but initially they're running with bogus stories. I think you certainly saw it in the Monica Lewinsky thing, where they were running all over the place with all kinds of stories that did not prove out. And I think that you can see that happening more and more, where you'll find, you know, networks and cable services are really being duped, being fed wrong information to serve, you know, a particular, you know, political agenda, and misleading the press and sending them in different directions, and they are broadcasting that information. And it happens because you're trying to move so quickly that you take a chance and you run with its story. But I think it blew up in their faces, certainly in that particular story. It's interesting. And as I say, because there are so many outlets, you can't perpetuate a lie for a long period of time. But you don't need to. You only have to have a shelf life of maybe sometimes 10, 12 hours of where, you know, the that audience there, they go, oh my God, or whatever, and you know, and you get that whole kind of an emotional reaction to it, then the story can move off. But by that time, the effect has been made. Well, I mean, I think the Monica Lewinsky story that somehow got it, you know, attached to, you know, Wag the Dog, only plays out in this connection, that there is a scandal in the White House, a real scandal. The movie had a scandal that supposedly the president was involved, you know, with someone, and that story was going to break, and then ultimately how are they going to handle that story, and what kind of ways can they move that story to another place, all the way to the point of saying to perhaps get us to the brink of war to get the attention off of the scandal. We picked something which we thought was pretty absurd, and suddenly this Monica Lewinsky, you know, mirrors what we're up to, and the Iraqi thing was happening, so it kind of mirrored what we were up to in terms of the premise of the piece. You know, we move much further along the line as we kind of show media manipulation, how you can manipulate the media, the abuse, you know, the use and the abuse of media, and how devious it all can become on many, many levels. So that's what intrigued us. And the fact is that some events in real life actually ran smack dab into what we were up to, as I say, which was our jumping off point.
This comment